please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
I mean, they always have a big mouth, they always talk a lot, so it happened before, it's gonna happen again.
Welcome back, tennis family. I'm your host, John Garica, and today we continue to celebrate 50 years of WTA tennis with our fantastic 50 series. As the WTA celebrates its 50th year in 2023, it's crazy. We're taking a closer look at some of the amazing moments in WTA history as we chat with the players that were actually there and have helped add to the legacy of the sport we all love so much. Today's fantastic 50 episode centers around a decade where I first fell in love with tennis, and it made me get obsessed right away back in the 90s. So everyone stop what you're doing, go grab your jean jacket, maybe some bright neon spandex, because it's time to examine a time in tennis where the hair was long and the tennis prodigies were aplenty. Let's talk about the WTA 90s. I'm joined this week by two Grand Slam champions that survived and thrived in this pivotal era in women's tennis history, each of whom accomplished some legendary wins that I can't wait to talk about today. Our first guest turned pro in 1988 and would go on to become one of South Africa's most accomplished female tennis players of all time. Having represented her country in Fed Cup and two Olympic Games, she would use her world-class serve and powerful ground strokes to reach world number 28 in singles and number 11 on the WTA doubles rankings. She'd play in three memorable Grand Slam finals, including the 1999 Wimbledon doubles final, as well as winning two Grand Slam mixed doubles titles with fellow South African David Adams. In total, she'd amassed seven career titles, which includes an emotional singles title at the 1998 Boston Cup that she won down match point and won 5 in the third set to capture the winner's trophy. She was a dangerous opponent for the best in the world and would ultimately retire in 2001 with wins over legends like Kimiko Date, Eva Maioli, and a memorable three-set victory over Hall of Famer Steffi Graf. I'm so happy to welcome to the show one of the best volleys I've ever seen in person, the fantastic Marianne de Schwartz. Marianne, welcome to Fantastic Tennis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, no, thank you. I'm playing WTA Matchmaker today, and I think I found you an excellent doubles partner for the show. So let's bring her out, okay? Our next WTA legend, born in Los Angeles, California, was a world-class junior, and she and partner Meredith McGrath impressively captured back-to-back US Open junior doubles titles before officially turning pro in 1991. Her superior court coverage and all-court game helped her climb all the way to world number 14 in singles, as well as world number 6 on the doubles court, which makes sense, as she would make a whopping 21 total tournament doubles finals, including the 2001 US Open final, with an ultimate haul of 6 career titles. Her biggest title of the 6 would come on the doubles court, this time in mixed, as she and American partner Donald Johnson would defeat two people you may have heard of in the final, Kim Clijsters and Leighton Hewitt, to win the 2000 Wimbledon mixed doubles title. She was among the best in the world on the singles court as well, and she proved that by defeating legendary names of the sport like Mary Pierce, Jennifer Capriati, Lindsay Davenport, and even the GOAT, Serena Williams. She retired from tennis in 2002, and she's here today to help us reminisce on a decade that saw her accomplish 450 combined match wins. Please welcome the fantastic Kimberly Poe. Kimberly, welcome.
Thanks so much, John. Exciting to be here.
I'm excited too. We get to talk about tennis today. This is really, really cool.
I know.
I know you both don't know me very well, but I know both of you very well because I grew up watching and cheering and supporting, and this is pretty cool today. So thank you both. This is going to be fun. Also, we're talking about a decade that really was unbelievable. It really, really was. I mean, it's 90s tennis. It's one of the toughest decades in the history of tennis. So we have a lot to cover today. We'll also have some 90s WTA trivia questions that will test each of your memories. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, that's gonna be a giveaway.
Well, this is your life, so.
Oh, I was thinking the same thing, Marion, so.
I'm going to go easy on you.
We're going to be good competition then.
Exactly. I can't remember what I had for breakfast today, so don't worry. I would never do that to you both. Yeah, I won't give you some crazy ones today. But why don't we just start with trivia, just since it's on the brain. Let's start us out fresh today. We're going to start with you, Marion, okay?
Okay.
Here we go. I told you at the top of the show that I had a great doubles partner picked out for you today, but you already knew that because you played doubles with Kim Poe already in your career. Can you tell me the name of the tournament that you and Kim Poe once played doubles at together?
Oh, boy. It was in America?
It was.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Can you remember, Kim?
You're going to give her the point already? I love it. Like a true doubles partner, setting up the volley for Kimberly Poe.
Hold on.
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to say.
We played together, Marianne.
One time.
We played together. We did?
One time.
See, it's so memorable for both of us.
Oh my gosh.
Actually, I had a friend of mine tell me this when I was still playing. She's like, you know what? When you get older, it's like everything is like one thing. You can't remember like a lot of stuff anymore. I'm like, I'll remember everything. But I mean, it's kind of true, you know?
I hear you. I will say that Pam Shriver was on the show and she was remembering set scores from like 1977. Oh. So just, I mean, she has that brain that was photogenic. It was absolutely crazy. All right. Are we giving, not even a guess?
I'm going to give her the point.
Really?
Yeah.
How about a guess? Let's go. Come on. It's in America.
Okay. I'm going to guess Hilton Head Island.
Okay. Pretty good. All right. It was Indian Wells, 2000.
Oh, I was going to say actually Indian Wells or Miami. And then I was like, nah, I don't think so. Oh, wow.
Indian Wells.
What year was that?
It was 2000.
Oh, wow.
It was 2000.
See, that's bad because that's even recent.
Kim, I kind of see how this is going to go today. So maybe we'll just kind of fast forward through some of these trivia questions. I can already tell if you didn't remember playing with her, you probably are not going to remember. Maybe give this one a guess. Here's your question. How many times did you play against Marianne in your career in singles and doubles combined?
Oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
Singles and doubles. You know, what's funny is I was even thinking about this before, knowing that she and I were going to be talking together. I was like, wow, how many times did we play each other? And I'm trying to stall, by the way, because I have no idea because I couldn't remember.
It's so interesting.
But then I remember seeing her serve against me. And so I was like, no, well, we've definitely played against each other. But singles and doubles, how many times have we played against each other? Do you know the answer to this one, Marianne?
Nope.
I'm gonna throw out two because I have no idea.
Two is correct. Well done. Oh. You're on the board.
Oh, wow. Look at you.
You're on the board.
Great guess.
That is so great.
I was going to say one singles, one doubles. Is that right or is that wrong?
Never in singles, both in doubles. Both in doubles.
Oh, okay. Both in doubles.
Now that we're talking about this, and I know it's, you know, believe me, if you were to tell me to think of something from a couple weeks ago, I know it would also be very difficult for me. I always say, I hope I never get robbed because I could never identify a suspect. I'm just not that person. But do matches come back on your brains every once in a while? I mean, it's been a couple decades now. Does anyone have dreams or is there just like, oh my gosh, I missed that volley for that shot or something? Does that ever come back to either of you?
I remember that. It's funny. I remember matches and then I also remember points, like specific points. I can remember what the weather was like, what I was wearing. But then there are instances where I'm like, I've never seen this person before in my life. But apparently I played against them, you know?
I mean, when you add up hundreds of matches, I mean, I can't imagine that you can keep everything straight anyway, so.
Yeah, so I don't know how it is for Kim, but I mean, you know, some of the things that I remember was, it was either I barely lost or I barely won, or I had match points against myself, you know, or I had match points and lost or vice versa. So those are some things I remember, you know, normal matches, you know, I'm definitely not Pam Shriver who's going to remember.
You remember the important stuff. Hey, I'm here to jog the memory. This is good. This is really good for everybody. You're going to think about, oh my gosh, I did those things. How amazing was I? You're going to pat yourself on the back after the show. That's what this whole show is about.
No, I know. That's why I'm like, this is going to be, it's a good show for you, John. It's a feel-good show.
It is a feel-good show for sure. I do want to talk about a little bit what's happened in your lives today, Marianne. I know you've stayed fairly close to the tennis world.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we both lived in Atlanta. We just talked about it briefly. And I actually went to one of your clinics and had a great time. You're living in Houston today. Are you still involved in tennis?
Yes, I actually, I live in Houston. I've been here for about 16, 17 years. And I'm the assistant director at River Oaks Country Club.
Amazing.
Yeah. So we host the U.S. Men's Clay Court Championships, which is a 250, and I'm involved with that. And I try and do a women's collegiate invitational every year as well to have some women's tennis here at the club. I mean, it's a beautiful, lovely club. I love it here. Not so much in the summer, but
exactly.
Kind of love living here in the middle of the country because I can just fly a couple of hours and I'm in Kim's neck of the woods out in the West Coast. So I fly out a couple of hours to the other side and I'm on the East Coast. So it's kind of centrally located and it's pretty easy to travel. So, I love living here for that reason.
Houston's great. It's just you have those interstates that kind of wind. It's very intimidating.
Oh, it's craziness over here with transportation and gunslinging Texans. And, it's a little bit crazy, but I love the people. Very friendly.
Exactly. Kim, the tour has changed dramatically in 20 years since you stopped playing tennis. Do you keep up with pro tennis at all today? Do you get to watch it all?
I watch a little bit. When I retired, I didn't want it to just be done for the most part. But then I still had some friends that played. Mm-hmm. So for a while, I'd only watch my friends.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't watch anything else. I watch a little bit more now because my husband travels with some of the men. So he watches all the time. So sometimes I'll be watching. But
for work. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Is there somebody that you love watching today that just kind of maybe is like a nostalgic kind of game or something that you just really that excites you when you see that player that's playing today?
On the women's tour, not really. I mean, my all-time favorite is to watch Roger Federer. I mean, because that's like watching beauty on the court. But
watching ballet.
Yeah,
for
that's
sure.
Exactly. It's exactly what it is. So.
Well, you can't go wrong with Roger Federer, for sure. We have a lot to cover today. And so I want to jump right in today. Here's how today will work. I'll start at the very beginning of the decade and we'll work through year by year, discussing some important moments in both WTA history and our guests' careers. I've enlisted the help from our listeners on Instagram at FantasticTennisPod and on Twitter at FanTennisPod to list some of their favorite WTA moments throughout the 90s. We won't have time to cover them all today, but we'll have other episodes in our Fantastic 50 series, and we'll also be joined by a fun cast of your favorite WTA players that will help us cover all the moments that helped make 90s tennis so special. So let's jump right into our tennis time machines today. Let's get right in. Let's go back to 1990. We opened 1990 in a very interesting place. Technology-wise, the tour had evolved and the newer composite rackets were the standard. The last time we'd actually see a wooden racket was at Wimbledon in 1987. And player-wise, we were fresh from the 1989 Chris Everett US Open goodbye. So the tour was now firmly in the hands of Steffi Graf to start us out as the number one player in the decade. Before we dig into the 90s, do either of you remember, I know that's going to be a point of contention today when I say that, do either of you remember your first tour match back in the late 80s? You both started roughly around the same time.
I don't remember my actual first tour match, but I do remember the first time I went to the US Open or when I went to a Grand Slam. So I was 15 years old when I went to Junior US Open and... Mm-hmm. I remember being completely overwhelmed and it was probably half the size it is now. I do remember that. I actually played Nicole Arendt in the first round. Every time I see Nicole Arendt, I'm like, man, you actually clobbered me because I was just, my jaw was like dragging on the ground. I was just so in awe of the size of everything and being in America and actually competing in the US Open, even though it was the junior. So for me, that was a pretty, it's a pretty significant match I remember. I mean, I think Nicole clobbered me 0-1 or maybe 1-1 or something, but I was just so overwhelmed. So that's what I remember.
I love it. I love it.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I don't remember my first tour match either. But same thing with Marianne. I remember my first slam match, which for me was also at the US Open. But the difference for me, Marianne, was that I played juniors US Open. Mm-hmm. So, and being the, young, ignorant junior that you are, you play the second week of a slam. So I still remember with Meredith McGrath being in line, we were standing in line in the food court, food area. And because we did well in doubles, we're there till the very end. So I remember being behind Mats Wielander and just like, joking with Meredith, like pretending like I'm giving him a hug and like, doing all this stupid kid stuff. And he turned around and I was like, oh, my gosh, I cannot believe he just turned around and I'm pretending like I'm hugging him. And he probably
funny.
Just knew it, just like those idiot kids. But so because I had played there twice before and not realizing that it was such a, a big, your end of the Grand Slam time, like of the second week, that when I went for the first time for pros, it was just like, oh, I'm back. I'm like, gosh, there's more people here now. It's a little more crowded. But because I was comfortable with it, it definitely, you know, helped with that moment.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it really, really does. We're going to talk about how well you did at the US Open as well in your career. A lot happened in 1990, so we'll definitely be covering some of these moments a little more in depth on future episodes. But Steffi Graf started out the year by winning the Australian Open by beating Mary Jo Fernandez. All's going according to plan for now. Monica Seles begins to make her claim to world number one as she wins her first Grand Slam of the French Open. But we'll start our discussion today at the 1990 Wimbledon event, where 33-year-old Martina Navratilova would win her ninth title, defeating then 27-year-old Zina Garrison in an All-American final. I know Wimbledon is a very important and special tournament to both of you, and which we're going to talk about later in the show. Marin, I'd like to start with you. Your game was so beautiful on the grass. It really, really was. We're going to talk about that run to the 99 doubles final in a little bit. But for those that aren't as familiar with your game, would you describe your game style to everyone listening? How did you like to play your tennis?
I kind of describe myself as an all-court player. I grew up on hard courts in South Africa, and actually had, you know, where I played most of my tennis, I actually played in a little bit of altitude. I believe it was about 5,500. It's not a huge amount, but it is a fair amount. You know, most of the tournaments was kind of played inland. There was tournaments played on the coast where it was, you know, obviously, you know, you can have a little bit more rallies. So I think a lot of the South Africans who grew up where I was, you know, Wayne Ferreira was there as well. Actually, Amanda Kutzer a little bit too, but her game was a little bit different. But I think, you know, being in altitude and being on hard courts, you know, points kind of ended quickly. You couldn't really hang back, you know, rallying. There wasn't that many rallies going. So I think that's part of why, you know, I developed a little bit more of a serve and volley, and also in South Africa we played a lot as kids. You know, we played a lot of doubles, we played a lot of mixed doubles. So with that, you kind of learn how to serve and volley and do all sorts of different things. So, you know, my game is an all court game, but probably a little bit more suited towards a little bit faster court, which was Wimbledon. I think they slowed down the courts quite significantly now. So it's not necessarily suited for serving and volleying, because you don't really see serving and volleying people win like they did before. But, you know, so my game was suited for a little bit faster court. But I think it took me a long time as a player to develop and learn how to rally and learn how to construct points a little bit better, and actually playing on clay and learning how to be patient and all that good stuff.
You're forgetting the power that you possessed as well. I mean, you really were such an aggressive, powerful groundstroker too. You had such a beautiful serve, and you really could set up those points very well. So it was always really, really beautiful watching you play. Kim, it was a memorable and historic run for Zina Garrison, actually, at that Wimbledon that I just mentioned. I remember that final vividly. It was one of my very first moments as a kid where I fell in love with tennis. You'd actually beat Zina at an event in Philadelphia in 1993. It was one of your very first big wins on tour. You'd actually make your very first tour semifinal at that event as well. And I always wondered, I guess, for someone as successful as you were, you played tennis in a decade that had so many top American players, Zina and Martina being two of them, of course. I know we're talking about an era as well where social media didn't exist. And so I'm probably guessing the pressure wasn't as much as it is today. But I always wondered, did you ever feel pressure to be the next Jennifer Capriati or Lindsay Davenport? I mean, you had such a great game.
Oh, me personally, no.
No?
Definitely not.
Never felt that.
No, because I was never, because we had so many great Americans, right? Like Lindsay, like everyone you're naming, Jennifer, but even who Marianne's talking about, Nicole, there's Meredith McGrath, there's Amy Frazier, there's Debbie Graham. I mean, Marianne Riddell, Mary Jo Fernandez.
Yeah, so many.
You know, both Williams sisters. Yeah, there's so many that for me, it was just more, I think everything I did was just a pleasant surprise. You know, USTA, I was never one of the, Ann Grossman, right? I mean, I could go on and on with all the names, but I was never one of the chosen US players. So it was no big deal. If I did really well in a tournament, I always thought the only people that knew were my parents, because they just, you know, oh, how'd you do? Well, okay, I won today, or I lost today, or
really?
Okay, well, you're still in the tournament? Yeah, I'm in, or I'm not in, but that was about it. I found out later I had some relatives that would, you know, look in the newspaper for the box scores, and that's how they would follow me. But I had no idea that, honestly, anyone followed me. My brother, I knew my brother did. But
of course, right?
That was about it. So no, I didn't feel any pressure at all. You know, back then, I think Michael Chang and I were the only Asians mm-hmm. in terms of U.S., even California. I mean, it's very different now. It would be very different now, for sure.
For sure. Did either of you find it hard to transition to the WTA tour in those early years? Was it a friendly tour back then when you first started coming on?
You know, looking back, I thought it was a very friendly tour. I was very shy when I came on tour. I didn't really know a lot of people. But, you know, as with anything, you know, our little South African players, a little community, we're always kind of like, we're together. And, you know, and then, you know, you kind of get a little bit more comfortable and you start meeting different people. But I thought the tour was pretty friendly. You know, I think with some of the top players, they're a little bit more reclusive. But for the most part, I thought the tour was, in general, pretty friendly.
For me, I was just, I would say, I would agree with Marion. For the most part, everyone was fairly friendly. I mean, I would hesitate to say like you'd become great friends mm-hmm. because they're your competitors everywhere you are. I think that's something people don't realize, that when you talk about the top 100, they're all your competitors. I mean, even beyond that, you know, your 50, 200 is still your competitor. So it's a little bit trickier, I did find, to have great friends on the tour. I would still go back home and mm-hmm. have those friends that I might kind of confide in more. Or
was it more, oh, they're going to find out my secrets, or they're going to find out because it was that competitive?
It didn't bother me. If I played Marion and she killed me, you know, and we were supposed to have dinner that night, I'd be like, okay, where do you want to go? I, you know, it's not a personal thing to me, mm-hmm. but I do think quite a few took it personally, or I don't know if you know, got a little too competitive on the court, or I don't know, gave a dirty look, or like same thing for me. I couldn't be bothered, but some people could.
Marianne, I mentioned Martina was 33 at the time of winning that 90 Wimbledon. That was practically ancient back then. How old were you when you retired in 2001?
I was 30, 31 years old, probably.
Yeah. I mean, to put in perspective now, Petra Kvitova, who is currently 10 in the world, yeah. won the Miami Open. She's 33 years old. I mean, Azarenka is still 17 in the world, playing some great tennis, 33 years old. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, wow.
Why was it such a big deal back then? It was such a narrative in the press that, oh my gosh, I mean, she's
so old. Yeah.
She's so old.
Well, I think players now are training better. They think they're eating better. Their diets are better. I think everything is just better as far as, you know, science, equipment is better. You know, I actually stopped because I was, you know, I didn't feel good anymore. My back was kind of, so it was actually I haven't had a problem with my back since, but my back was giving me a lot of issues, especially with my serve and everything. I don't know if it's true or not, but somebody like Novak Djokovic, he uses a hyperbaric chamber, and his diet is crazy. I mean, he moves around and he looks like a 20-year-old, and he's, what is he, 34, 35. Mm-hmm. So looking back now, I wish I'd played a little bit longer. You know, I really enjoyed playing, and I enjoyed being competitive and all that stuff. I mean, so yeah, I mean, it wasn't meant to be, but I think back then, you know, Kim, when did you stop? Were you in 30 something too?
Just after you.
Just after,
yeah,
me.
2002, yeah. I was 31. But you know, John, that's interesting. It's no coincidence that Martina was, you know, the first one to be able to go that long and still be the supreme athlete she was, because she was the one that kind of ironically, right, put fitness on the map for women. Like she was, I think, right, the first one to.
Yeah, I think Martina and Ivan Lendl for the guys, actually.
And I remember Martina, she gave me a book. I think it was, it had to be early 90s. And it was about being vegan, essentially. It was a little bit more than that, but it was, you know, saving the world because of the greenhouse effect of animals. And just, I read the whole thing. It was so interesting, but I knew that that's how
when Martina Navratilova hands you a book, you read it, right? I'm going to read this book.
She's like, you should read this. I'm like, okay, let me get to this.
If she asked me a question in chapter 9, I better know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. I'm like, which page? Yeah. But there's no coincidence, because she watched everything that she put in her body. So it wasn't just a training, and it wasn't just how she ate. Like, she did it all, the whole package. And that's, you know, why she was so incredible for so long.
Exactly. We're going to move on to 1991, but I will say, I'll leave you with, on that note, I mean, Venus Williams this year starting her 30th year on the WTA Tour.
Wow.
This is her 30th year playing tennis. We're going to talk about Venus in a bit. In 1991, now we have Monica Seles, who finally catches Steffi and becomes number one in the world. She became the youngest number one on March 11th, 1991 in tennis history, Graf having been number one for 186 consecutive weeks at that point. Now we're into 1992, tennis phenom Jennifer Capriati won the gold medal at the Barcelona Olympics. It was a big moment for her as she beat Steffi Graf in a three-set final. The Olympics have become a much bigger deal these days for tennis players. Marianne, you played Fed Cup for South Africa for many years. You actually played in two Olympic games, that same one that Jennifer won in 92. You played again in 96 in Atlanta, beating Helena Suková in a great first round match. I mean, that was a 7-5 in the third rumble, which I love. I love when two of my favorites play. Were those Olympic experiences up there for you in your career, or is it more the Grand Slams always that you kind of had your eye on?
You know, the Olympics was very special. I mean, to me, it's very different than the Grand Slams. I think for one, when, you know, South Africa was banned since, I think, 1962 to participate in the Olympics. So when we were allowed back in Barcelona, I mean, it was a huge deal for, you know, for all of us. So I think, so that was very special to me, you know, being part of the Olympics. But I don't know if I can put it in the same category as a Grand Slam. It's just different, you know. I mean, I was excited about the tennis, but I mean, I was super excited to go and watch other sports, you know, and just be part of it. So
it's special, right? It's just special. Kim, you were nominated to play Fed Cup in 1997, which is a huge deal because, like I said, when we go through the roster of Americans that played during your era, I mean, we could have five Fed Cup teams, really, with that American team. I mean, that easily. You played in two Fed Cup matches, going undefeated, by the way, in Fed Cup play. 2-0. Come on.
Go, Kim. Go, Kim. Go, Kim.
Air high five to Kim Po. You played once in Holland and you played once in the United States. You beat Naoko Saomatsu, a great Japanese player. And it was really, really cool. Did you feel different in those moments playing Fed Cup? Were those special moments for you, or was it just like another match for you?
No, they definitely were very special. You know, for the most part, I didn't get that nervous playing. I don't know why, I just didn't. I remember being shockingly nervous for both of those matches.
Oh.
Especially playing Naoko in Boston. Because that was in the States.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, did the other one count? I think it was already a dead match.
No, it was a dead rubber. But
yeah,
but Saomatsu counted. I mean, that's a big pressure.
Yeah, that's
match.
Right. That's why it was a bigger moment. But I mean, I think even if I lost, we knew that our team was still going to win, but it was still, I still remember it's probably the only time we're walking out. I was a little shaky. And all other matches, it was just, I don't know, just another match for the most part. But I remember being very nervous.
I love it. South Africa also had a great team. You had a great team too, Marianne. Yeah. You and Amanda and Liesl Huber-Horn. I mean, there were so many great players back then too. I mean, we're moving on to 1993. A lot happened this year, but nothing more horrific than the 93 Seles incident in Hamburg, which we'll touch upon in another episode. Kim, you'd start the year in 1993 getting to your first of 21 career doubles finals with Shannon McCarthy in Brisbane. And then you'd reach another final with Amy Fraser, with whom you played steadily with in the 1990s. Amy was on our show too. Amy could not remember a damn thing about anything. She's like, oh, I played there. Oh, I did. I was like, I fell in love with Amy Fraser for sure. Kim, can you talk about partnerships in your career? What did you look for in a doubles partner? Because we're getting into the meat of your doubles career in a moment. Was it personality, or did they have to have certain weapons like a big serve like Marianne?
No, I mean, maybe I should have been better at that. which, you know, it's funny that I just talked to Amy this morning.
Oh, you did? Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. I did tell her that I was doing this with you, Marianne, and John. The only thing I looked for in a partner was someone that I would enjoy playing with. That was it. And not even like necessarily play well together with, but just be able to talk to on the court, someone that that I didn't think would get mad at me when I played, because there were a lot of girls that, you know, I get a little upset if they think that you're missing a shot. But
I'm guessing who. I'm just going through a Rolodex of players that you played with, and I'm like, I wonder if this person. Marianne, were you the same way? Was it more of a business for you? Or
I probably should have made it a little bit more of a business deal, but I'm kind of like Kim. You know, I wanted to play with people that, you know, that would be supportive and that I would have fun with, that I can laugh with, that and people who, I mean, obviously wanted to win. It's not like I just go out there and and not care. So I really enjoyed playing with people that I liked, and you always end up doing reasonably well with people that you like and you have a great time with, and that was really important to me, you know.
You played with some legends. I mean, your list, both of you, some great names, but I mean, we're talking Novotna, Kornikova, Martina, and Navratilova, Marianne. I mean, so many great players. I'm curious though, how did doubles partnerships dissolve in the 90s? There wasn't social media then. There wasn't email where you can just, you know, say, hey, we're not going to play together. Yeah, no, we just won a tournament, but we're going to, you know, maybe separate.
There was a couple divorces in the doubles court here and there. But for the most part, I mean, you know, sometimes say Kim and I decide to play, we'll say, hey, well, let's play the next 4 months together, or let's play until Wimbledon and let's see how we do, you know. And if we do well, we continue. And if we feel like, we need to play with somebody different, we do, you know. But I think it was verbally, or other times when you go and you sign up, you see, oh, wow, Kim signed up with somebody else. Okay, I guess I got to find somebody else.
Okay, so that's how it went. I wonder, I mean, if that's like the norm and you're just
sometimes,
like,
sometimes, hey. And you know, other times, you know, I didn't really, I mean, I knew I was going to play doubles, but I didn't really plan on having a specific partner. And I get to a tournament and I just talk to people and ask, like, hey, I'm looking for a doubles partner, you know, to obviously, you know, to people that I think I would like to play with. And that's how you kind of hook up as doubles players. Now, you know, it's, you can tweet and Instagram and you can pretty much do anything and try and get somebody to play with you, and
I love it,
or break up with them. But yeah, it was a little bit more direct and subtle in the 80s and 90s.
It sure was. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot more person to person. Yeah. You had no choice back then.
Verbal communication.
Yeah. Plus I think nowadays you have a whole team. Back then we didn't, what am I going to send my mom to go talk to like Marianne while she's on the practice court? I mean, you know, that doesn't happen.
That would have been great. You know, Martina Hingis sent her mom to break up with a lot of doubles partners. Come on.
That was probably the beginning of it, right? That was the beginning of all of that changing. So
I think, and I won't throw this player under the bus. I won't say who it is, but.
We love buses. It's okay. Keep going.
But I remember this was towards the end of my career. You know, I was looking for somebody to play with, and I went to a playoff. You know, we played once and we played pretty well together, and I was like, hey, you know, looking for somebody to play doubles with. And she actually, she's like, can you speak with my mom or my agent? And I was like, whoa. maybe she didn't want to play with me, which is fine, but it was, I think that was the start of that whole thing, you know. So
a different era really of tennis too. I mean, that's just towards that, you know, that 2000s. It's just a, you know,
yeah,
you saw all these...
I literally think now, like, I mean, agents and parents are putting teams together. I don't know how much, and maybe there still is some verbal communication, but I just don't know how much. I mean, I'm not around to.
It was the money. It was all the money, you know, they can afford it back then.
Yeah.
We're ready for our second WTA 90s quiz question today, Marianne. Here's your second one.
Okay.
We're in 1993. In 1993, I feel bad now. I don't know these questions. In 1993, you only played one singles match in 1993.
Yeah.
That entire year. Can you remember which Grand Slam champion you played that match against in 1993?
Oh my God.
One singles match in 1993.
Yeah, I had shoulder surgery, so I didn't play most of the year.
I was going to ask what it was in 93.
Yeah, I had shoulder surgery, so I didn't play most of the year. Shoot. I'm going to say...
You beat her many other times after that.
Many other times. I have no idea.
Renee Stubbs.
Okay. Okay.
I thought you meant singles slam champion.
I know. I would love to watch a Renee Stubbs Miranda Schwartz match. I just would love, I mean, I love the contrasting styles. How amazing. You just mentioned 93, the shoulder. I would love to get, let's do injury roll call right now with both of you, because I know injuries are so prevalent, and injuries can either end a career or it could really lead to healing and breathe new life into a career. Can we get a roll call of all the injuries you had, Marianne? And then I want to hear from Kim. So you had shoulder?
Yeah, I actually had two major shoulder surgeries, and I recovered really well from both. But you know, I was pretty lucky with injuries, except with my shoulder. You know, the two shoulder surgeries I had. The thing that kind of ended it for me was my back. And I touch wood, I don't have any back issues now. But I think it's just the day in and day in grind, and I didn't want to do all the work anymore. And you know, it was just too much. So
you're serving bombs, Maren. That's why, you know, the show makes sense.
Not so much anymore, John.
Uh-oh. John, that means that I don't have an excuse for my shoulder injury then, because I was not serving bombs, and yet I still had the shoulder injury.
Do you?
It should mean that it didn't. Yeah, that was it for me. I just had shoulder.
Shoulder. Ugh, that damn shoulders.
Well, I don't think your joints are made to do that movement 10 million times. You know, I think at some point I've had enough. That's it, you know?
Kim, here's your second WTA quiz question from the 90s. You'd get the first of two career wins against this multiple Grand Slam champion in the summer of 1993. And she'd finish that year at number 12 in the world.
Two.
It's a big one. Grand Slam champ.
Oh my God.
Two big wins against her.
Come on, Kim.
93.
I love it. Your doubles partner's cheering you on. We're not doing so great. She also wore glasses like you did.
I mean, there can't be that many people that wore glasses.
Which not many players did.
Who wore glasses?
Was she blonde? Was she blonde?
She was blonde.
She was blonde?
You have no, I love that Kimberly Poe has no clue that you beat this player twice. She was like 90, come on, 93. Big year for you.
I beat her twice.
Legend, Hall of Famer. So nice. Nice person. Are you going to cheat? She's walking right now, everybody. She's taking her computer. She's like, I am not losing this point. I am going to Google this right now. Who the hell did Kimberly Poe beat in 1993?
Yeah, my time's up. I have no idea who I beat twice.
Mary Pierce.
Oh!
Mary Pierce.
That is bad.
Before we move on from 93, I will say, I mean, one of my favorite moments of the year, it was the Graf-Novotna final too. I know you played doubles with her. I mean, that was such a moment, right? I had Hanna Manlikova on the show and she talked about that moment coaching Jana through that tournament. So I highly recommend everyone go and listen to that episode. It was fascinating. Listen, highly recommend. Right, we're in 1994. Look, we're speeding right along. Ladies, thank you for joining this time machine. October 31st, 1994 in Oakland, California, Venus Williams made her debut against Sean Stafford, who was ranked 59 in the world at the time. Kim, you were there.
I was there.
We got to talk about it for 1 second. You won your first round match against Caroline Kuhlman. You played Lindsay Davenport in the second round. You lost nearly 7-6 in the third in that match, by the way. I mean, that's a tough one. I hate those matches. Can you take us back to that tournament, the buzz? It was crazy.
It was crazy.
The first time you saw Venus Williams, what do you remember from that moment in tennis history?
It was something that we had never experienced before on the tour. Just the amount of just buzz. And I mean, I think it's more common now, but for us back then, the tournaments were fairly quiet, except for maybe the Grand Slams and even end of the Grand Slams maybe, but it was craziness from qualifying because Venus is already there and it's just the hype. And yeah, it was like a scene.
I mean, the pressure of that draw ceremony, everyone's like, no one wants to play this player. I'm sure someone took Sean aside and said, it's going to be okay. It's cool. We're good. You're going to be talked about in history for 30 years now. We still talk about Sean Stafford. University of Florida, I think too. Yeah, she's a Gator. Maren, you played Venus at a tournament in Oklahoma in 1998. You played her in doubles three times in Zurich, Australian Open, Wimbledon. You had so many great matches against the Williams sisters, and you played against, I mean, we're talking legends, both of you on the tour. Where do you rank Serena and Venus all time as doubles opponents? I know that's a little unfair based on where they kind of evolved, but I mean, you played through these generations of players that were double specialists, really.
Yeah, I think the difference with Venus and Serena compared to like playing, I never played against them. I never played doubles against Martina and Pam, but I did play against Gigi and Natasha Zareva. I think the difference with the Williams sisters were their power. I mean, they could literally annihilate you with their power. Whereas, you know, with other players, I mean, you always feel like you got a chance. You know, you didn't have like 125 mile an hour serves and returns coming at you, you know. So they were physically so strong and powerful. And I think there was a little bit of an intimidation factor there too, you know. I mean, they are very athletic, they're strong. And I think a lot of players now are like that. But, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, I mean, you didn't have that many power players and players that were physically that strong and fast and literally just, you know, whip you off the court.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Like I said, 30th year for Venus Williams, and who knows, maybe Serena comes back. I still have bets that she comes back. You know, you just never know. You just never know. It's time for 1995. It's 95 time. And Marianne, this was a big year for you, as not only would you win your first of four WTA titles on the clay at Bournemouth Championship with Romanian's Ruxandra Dragomir, but you would play at an event in Brighton, England, and end up winning the biggest tennis match of your entire life. And you defeat world number one Steffi Graf in three amazing sets. Can you take us back to that match? I mean, obviously, people still talk about this match today and about your head-to-head, because you played her three times. You win three sets every single time. I mean, Steffi would blow people off the court.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. When I played top players, I was never really intimidated. And for some reason, you know, with Steffi, with her backhand being a little bit weaker, I always felt like I can expose it. You know, she didn't come to the net. I felt a lot of pressure when I played against people who came to the net, because I had to find a way to pass them, and my backhand was kind of crappy, so and people went after my backhand. So I just always felt like I matched up well against Steffi, because, you know, I served and volleyed, and I could expose a backhand a little bit more, and especially on a little bit faster court. I always happen to play her on a little bit faster court. You know, I've never played her on a slower court, so I don't know. Maybe she would have beaten up on me on a slower court, but I just never felt intimidated by, you know, other people. It was all about how I woke up and how I felt, and if I felt good and if I felt confident that day, I felt like I could beat anybody. But, you know, on the other hand, I can also lose against anybody. So
it's nuts. I think matchups are so important on the WTA Tour. They really, really are. I mean, I think in the press back then, I think Steffi was quoted as saying, "No woman has ever played that well against me as well." Just so you know, not just to, you know, pat yourself on the back.
Yeah.
Kim, was there anybody that you played that you just hated seeing in the draw? Was there one player that you're just like, oh no, not her, just like anybody, but.
Well, besides Steffi, because I was the exact opposite from Marianne. She was probably like, okay, so I'll be on the court for 35 minutes because I'm playing Kim, and then I'll have to get a practice match next because this is not even going to make me sweat. No, pretty much Steffi. I was just like, okay, so let's get the flight home. I mean, maybe I can win two games this match. Let's go for two. You can do
That's crazy.
That was,
oh man,
the other person that I could not beat, and it was Karina Hapsidova.
Oh,
could not beat her at all, not even get close. Yeah,
I love those matchups. That's just so funny.
Wow. Yeah, personally, I hated playing Lindsay Davenport and also actually Monica Seles, because they did everything so well.
Amazing.
They hit so hard off both sides and so accurate. I never felt like I had a chance to expose anything. I mean,
this is so funny, because when you were talking about your game, when you're explaining your game, and I was thinking about your game, and I was thinking like, oh, Marianne was like, she could do anything, right? Marianne could, you know, just hit any ball. That's the way her game was. So it's funny because we are complete opposite players, because those were the two players in terms of top that I enjoyed playing.
No, I hated playing them. They were just so difficult to play, because they didn't have any weaknesses except their movement, but they hit the ball so hard. Like, I never felt I could get in a rally to try and expose that a little bit. It was just so tough for me to mentally play against both of them.
And the consistency too. I mean, you could do it week in and week out. I mean, it was amazing. Kim, we're at 1996, Kimberly, and at a lead-up event to the US Open, you played some of the best singles matches of your career to become the first woman ever to advance from qualifying to the semifinals of the Canadian Open. And you did so by winning all your matches in straight sets. Along the way, you defeated two top 10 players for the first time, world number 5 Anca Huber and world number 8 Mary Jo Fernandez, before losing in the semis to Arantxa Sanchez Vicario. Amazing run. Really, really. That's kind of fun, right? You went from...
That was fun.
Yeah, 165 in the rankings in 1995 to 23. In the world in 1996. Ultimately, you'd reach number 14 the next year in 1997. Were you always trying to shoot for top 50? I guess for both of you guys, this is a great question. Your goals wise, was it Grand Slams? Was it, oh, I need to get to this next level, to 20, to 30? How did you prioritize goals back then on tour in the 90s?
I never looked at points. I know there are people that would check points and I need to get to this round and this tournament to get to this ranking. And I don't know. I just never did that. Maybe it's growing up. My parents never pressured me to, you know, you have to be number one or you have to, I mean, that I didn't have any of that. So for the most part, I wanted a ranking that would be high enough where I could go play where I wanted to play. Where I could get into the singles tournaments I wanted to get into. And that was pretty much it. You know, stay at times where you're kind of fluctuating. It's like, stay in the main draw for sure of slams, but tier one, tier two, that's how I kind of did my gauge.
Maren, did you have goals like that?
I think when I started, you know, I mean, every year I would make myself a ranking goal as far as, you know, I want to be in the top 200 by the end of the year. And then, you know, maybe you reach that a little bit earlier and then you go, oh, okay, maybe I'm, you know, 150. I think I had ranking goals, but I also had most of my goals was just keep working on improving my game and not worry so much about, like Kim said, not look at the points. Who am I playing? How much money am I going to make? Because I think if you start getting into those things, you kind of lose the plot a little bit. So I always try to focus on keep improving and just, you know, if you do the right things, the wins will come, you know.
We're moving on to 1997, and Martina Hingis has now shifted as a dominant player in the WTA by winning 5 singles Grand Slams in between 1997 and 1998. Kim, this was arguably your best year on tour as well. You'd start the year by upsetting Lindsay Davenport. I mean, amazing win to reach the quarterfinals of the 1997 Australian Open, which was, in a lot of people's opinions, your best match of your career. I'd love to know if you thought. You'd lose to Amanda Kutzer in 2 tight sets in that next round, which really tough. I mean, gosh, Kutzer. I mean, she married well, too. I mean, God bless Amanda Kutzer, for sure. I'm guessing if you have any singles match from your career that you'd like to replay, do you think it's that Amanda Kutzer match, that quarterfinal? If I gave you the power to travel back and pick any singles match or doubles match from, well, we'll talk singles for a second, but any match from your career, is that the match you'd want to replay?
Oh, you know what? It's either that one or the one against Monica at the US Open.
Yeah, that's another good one.
Yeah,
that's
another good one. Maybe that one more, Monica, because Amanda was always so hard for me to play, like her style of game was just brutal. And obviously she was playing unbelievably then because she beat Steffi, I think, either the match before that or the...
Yeah. Steffi didn't like to play the South Africans.
I know. There must have been something like you guys just knew how to play her.
Yeah. I feel like they had like a whole Venn diagram of like, this is what we're going to do.
You guys had meetings about, I should have joined in those meetings. Maybe I could have won a couple more games.
Exactly.
But I was very disappointed that I lost, but in terms of matches played against Amanda, it wasn't one of my worst. So
yeah, I think it was 4-4. It was a solid match for sure.
Yeah.
Marianne, did you have a match in your singles career that you wish you could have gone back to play? I mean, you did have a great second round match with Steffi Graf at Wimbledon.
If this one, maybe Kimiko Date, I think at the fourth round of Wimbledon, maybe. I just, you know, tactically, I don't feel like I played a good match. I felt like it was a good matchup for me against her, but I just didn't play a good match, you know. Sometimes you have the right plan, but you just don't execute, and I just didn't execute that day. Yeah, that's probably the only one, really. I mean, there's always matches. You can look at every single match you've played in your career and go, man, I coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know?
Good for you. You both are just very much like, you know, it is what it is. I love it. I love this perspective today. Definitely. I can't move on from 97 until I do say, because I know you have kids, Kimberly. I don't know if you've shown your kids this match or maybe if you told them, but you did beat Serena Williams in 97. I have to throw that out there. I mean, Kremlin Cup, come on. That's like, that's a pretty cool moment.
That match was not televised. I mean,
what?
I remember that match. It was her first match, I think. Wasn't it qualifying in Moscow?
No, it wasn't
qualifying.
It was the first round.
It felt like qualifying to me just because, you know how you're talking about matches that you can remember? That's one I remember. But because, you know why? It's because of all the hype for Venus and because I was at that. And then we play in Moscow. And it was like, even though it should have been bigger because she should, you know, she was talked up to be better, which in terms of their careers, obviously she was. But because I was in Moscow, it was like, I don't even know who was there.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? I mean, just, gosh, I just love today. I love today. Thanks for sharing these. We're winding down today. In our WTA time machine, we've landed in 1998, and this is the year that both Marianne de Schwartz and Kimberly Poe had been waiting for. It was time to win some titles. Marianne, you would start in 1998. You were playing some great tennis again. You defeated Eva Maioli in Hilton Head, and you'd win a big doubles title in Eastbourne with the legend Jana Novotná, and you'd make the Wimbledon doubles semifinal with Debbie Graham. And before we go on, can you mention just really quickly what it was like to play with Jana? I everyone's such a big fan, and you know, you got to play with her.
Yeah, you know, I wish I played with Jana a little bit more. I really loved playing with her, not just because she was a great doubles player, great athlete, but she was really sweet. I mean, all I remember when we played was we laughed so much, and I really don't really know about what, but I think we just kind of made each other laugh with stupid things. We were relaxed when we played, you know, so I think that's why we played pretty well too. And like I said, I wish I could have played with her a little bit more. You know, she was super fun to play with.
Well, you were relaxed in August of 1998 as well, because you'd play an event in Boston, Massachusetts, and match by match, you'd continue to play some fantastic tennis, beating great players like Anke Huber and Lisa Raymond and Natalie Deshi before coming up against Barbara Schett in your first WTA singles final. Can you walk us through that really quick? I mean, I mean, gosh, how emotional is that? I mean, you were down 1-5 in the third match points. I mean, what was that reaction like, Marianne? That must have been amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that week. There was actually a lot of rain that week. I mean, I had to play like a lot of matches in one day, and I had to do it like 2 days in a row. And I remember when the singles final was there, I mean, I was exhausted. I was absolutely exhausted. And somehow, sometimes you are able to turn things around. And that was just one of those matches where I was able to kind of find that a second gear, and I found a little bit of energy, and I was able to come out on top. So I mean, you know, those are fun matches, you know, if you're on the giving end and not on the receiving end of it, you know. So
congratulations, that's very, very cool. Kim, August was great for Marianne, but September was really better for you, because after six appearances in WTA finals, you'd win your very first title with one of my very favorites, Lori McNeil, really great, in Quebec City. How was that moment for you? Because you're in six finals and you're just like, oh my gosh, I want to win a title already.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you remember that winning that title? Was that just like, oh, thank goodness?
Yes, exactly. I remember that. I remember not, well, Lori, and also Lori, right? Marianne, you know, Lori, there was no like jumping up and down ever with Lori. So, but I remember when we won, it was like, finally won a final. Huh? Yeah, that was more the feeling, you know. Lori, just, I was like, what's this, like number 20 for you? I mean, thanks, you know, because seriously, I think she probably had won that many by then. So she was a great partner, though. She actually taught me so much about doubles, just playing with her. And
Lori's an amazing tennis player and person, and
person,
just fun
yeah.
to play with. She's awesome. I love her.
So fun to watch. So, so fun. All right. We're at 1999. We're here. We did it. Well done. We've made it. And we're in the thick of big hitting tennis. And Hinga starts the year by defeating Maresmo in that Australian Open final. If we want to go there and remember some of those questionable comments, I mean, that was a tough time. I'd love to have Maresmo on the show just to kind of to get her thoughts on what she thought of 1999. But on a happier note, Marianne, after being on tour for over a decade, the hard work and sweat and practice and effort paid off, as you'd have your most successful doubles season by winning the mixed doubles title in Australia. And you'd also advance to the Wimbledon doubles final later that year.
Mm-hmm.
That Australian Open final, I mean, we just talked about Serena Williams. I mean, you won in the most dramatic of fashions. I mean, it's 7-6 in the third, beating Max Mirny and Serena Williams. Come on, that's an iconic moment.
Yeah, it was pretty fun. We went, obviously it was on stadium, and I think they didn't think the match was going to go on for so long. So, you know, I mean, it was really a very, very good match. And then, you know, at some point, I remember I heard the umpire talking to the referee, and they were like, they better finish this match. We might have to move them, because the singles final is televised worldwide, and the whole stadium was packed because everybody was coming in for the men's final as well. So,
oh my gosh,
it was a great atmosphere. It was almost like, you know, winning a singles to me, because of the amount of people that they were. I mean, playing against, you know, Serena and Max. I mean, we went into the match, you know, hoping that we had a shot. But I mean, I think if if we were in Vegas, I think nobody would have given us a shot to win. So, I mean, it was a fun match to win and come out on top. I think it was like 7-5 maybe, or 8-6 in the third set tiebreaker. So it was a pretty very, very close match. It was very fun to play.
Is that a match you've gone back to watch on YouTube? Have you seen that one again?
I've never seen it before.
Oh my gosh.
I've never seen it.
Kim, you'd reach your first Grand Slam final as well in mixed that year. And you reach your second US Open final in 2001 with Natalie Tosia, who... I mean, another fantastic doubles player. I mean, gosh, I mean, you guys sure picked your partners. You'd win your Grand Slam in mixed the very next year at Wimbledon in 2000. And that situation was very familiar, just kind of like Marianne, who's playing Serena Williams in the final. But you played Kim Clijsters and Leighton Hewitt in your final. I mean, you both had to earn your doubles titles. I mean, come on. That's like another iconic duo. What was that like? Especially because they were dating at the time, too. Everyone's like, oh, come on. They're like the couple.
They were dating, yeah. That was part of it, though. I'm like, ooh, maybe we can get them in a fight. And then, you know, because that's kind of what it was. It was, are we supposed to beat them? I don't think we're supposed to, but maybe we can get them to, like, not like each other so much and then have a better shot at this. But, you know, it's the same thing. My partner, he's still one of my greatest friends. He was just he's such a good guy. And we just had so much fun during that match, and just during all of them. But I do remember that match, yeah, because my mom flew out from LA when she knew we were going to play. And it was just, and we had a pretty good crowd. It was that, well, there was a ton of rain that year. So we actually played our finals the same time that Pete played to break, was it Bjorn's? There was some
record.
I wish I probably should remember this. Yeah, he had to break, he was going to break some record at Wimbledon the same time, the same day. But we still had an unbelievable crowd because they had so much rain. We were on court one. So that was like a arms to the air win. Not like a thank you, but it was like a yes. Yeah.
Totally. That's so awesome. That's so amazing. And then your run in 99, Mariana, with Elena Tartakova. I mean, you played some amazing teams to get to that final. Suarez and Rano Pascual, Mary Jo and Monica, Novotna and Zvereva. Can I just ask blanketly, because I know most of what we're talking about today, you had such great careers, but a lot of the success, especially in mixed doubles for both of you, your Grand Slams came towards the end of your careers. Did you appreciate it more at that point? I mean, is that something where you can say, oh my gosh, I've put in so much work. I've put in all this effort for a decade on tour. And, you know, I deserve this. Like I worked hard for this Grand Slam. I mean, did you feel like maybe it would have been a little different had you had success? I don't know, like a Kournikova, I guess, early in her career?
I think for me personally, I think at some point as you get a little bit older, you kind of think your time has come and gone, you know, you don't think that it will happen. And but I think that's the great thing about, I think, anything you do with passion and hard work. If you just persevere and you just keep going, you know, good things are going to happen, you know. So I was lucky enough to still be playing and still healthy. And, you know, sometimes, you know, everything just lines up. And it was towards the end of my career. And I'm very thankful because I'm sure as maybe this happened to Kim too. I mean, there was times when you play and it's hard work and you're away from your family and it's a lot of traveling that you don't want to do it anymore. But, you know, and then you're like, oh, you know what? Been doing this for so long. I'm just going to work a little bit harder. I'm going to try a little bit more. And, you know, if you stick around long enough, you know, good things always happen. And, you know, I'm very thankful for that. So,
yeah, I agree with Marianne that it is. I do think when I think about, oh, let's see if I played mixed. Well, I did play mixed, you know, in the beginning but of my career. If I would have won Wimbledon back then, would it have meant the same? And it probably wouldn't have, because you're just kind of like, oh, that was awesome, you know, instead of like, that was awesome, you know. It's a different, mm-hmm. you would appreciate it differently because of the hours that you spend, the time that you're gone, and especially with mixed, right? So it's like and doubles, it's the extra time that you're going to stay at the slam or stay at the tournament a lot of times. Because you're not necessarily still there for singles, but mm-hmm. you know, you still have to practice. You still have to do everything as if you're a singles player. You don't get to go out and party and then, hey, let's go play. I mean, I don't know, maybe some people do, but you know, so it's, you're still working towards something, and it's definitely a great feeling, reward.
We just sped through an entire decade of tennis with two legends. We're finishing up today with fan questions for each of you. Marianne, I'll start with you. Your fan question has to do with an experience that happened in 2000. A fan on Facebook, Alyssa Arminio, asks, in 2000, Martina Navratilova came back to the tour and you were her first doubles partner at an event in Madrid. What was that experience like? Was it nerve-wracking having to play with her when she's coming back because the expectation was so tough? Did you feel a certain way, I guess?
You know, luckily I was a little bit older. I think if I was younger, it would have been a lot more nerve-wracking. But Kim, I don't know if you've played with Martina, but I think there's a lot of expectation and a lot of pressure already. Never mind the amount of pressure I put on myself to do well and, you know, in tournaments. But I think there was a lot of, from what I remember, I think there was a lot of hype with her coming back and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I was kind of relieved after we played our first match. I was like, okay, thank God, you know, now we can actually play tennis. So, you know, and it's tough playing with Martina. I mean, she expects perfection, you know, from herself and then from her partner, you know. So
did you know she was coming back? Did she give you a call and say that? Or how did that even formulate? Did she say, okay, I'm going to come back and I want you to kind of help me? Or, you know, you're playing some great tennis.
Well, she was looking to maybe start playing again. And I was, you know, I was actually looking for a partner. Mm-hmm. And we just happened to talk. And she's like, well, you know, do you want to play? And I was like, sure. And I actually thought she was kidding, to be honest with you. And so we ended up playing a couple of tournaments. So it was fun. And I was glad that I could, you know, play with her. I think that's the first time we ever actually played a tournament. So it was fun.
It jump-started some Grand Slams for her too. She had a great comeback, you know, she won some more titles.
Yeah. We actually played really well at Wimbledon. We played really, really well at Wimbledon. I think we lost against the Williams sisters. They ended up winning. So we played very well together and it was fun. After I got over the nerves.
Kim, your fan question comes from Instagram. It's at DaveRep1077. And it's kind of similar to Marianne's question. He says, I know this wasn't in the 90s, but in 2002, Karina Morariu had an emotional comeback to the tour and you played doubles with her during that first event back. What do you remember from that emotional comeback?
Yeah, that was emotional because she got sick right before the French Open. Mm-hmm. And it was all very, very fast because I actually saw her a couple of weeks before that at a tournament. And I remember it because we were hitting and she had this giant bruise on her leg. And I said to her, I'm like, did you get hit by a ball? What happened there? What's going on? She's like, I don't know. And then that was the beginning of figuring out her leukemia. But
wow.
Yeah, because it was so serious that I flew back after Strasbourg to Florida to see her in the hospital. And then flew back to the French. And because I was playing with Natalie Toziat, I asked her, I said, please ask them for a Thursday start for doubles. Can you tell them I'm going to fly back to see Karina? Because I'm not sure if she's going to make it. So, and then I remember, I think I might've been her first hit after coming back. You know, I went and we went for the first hit. And I think she could only hit for like 15 minutes. And she was just exhausted. And it was maybe because I went through so much with her before actually stepping on the court with her, that it was okay. Like I knew that she was okay at that point. The other times were probably tougher. And so it was just more just like, okay, we got to have some fun. Like we know what you've been through and now you got to just enjoy this time out here instead of looking at it as your job or whatever you want to look at it as. So, but yeah, that was a great moment for her and to share with her. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. Thank you both today. I want to thank these two legends for joining us today. Their stories, their contribution to the WTA Tour, Marianne and Kimberly. Thank you so much for your time today. It's really remarkable what you both did in your careers.
Oh, thanks, John.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
If you enjoyed the show today, please leave us a fantastic review on Apple Podcast. It means a great deal to hear your feedback. And as always, please go follow us on Instagram at FantasticTennisPod or on Twitter at FanTennisPod. I'm John Garica, and thank you for listening. This has been fantastic.
It was good seeing you, Marianne.
You too. Bye.